Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Zoom. Zoom Phone is a top-tier cloud phone solution with the same ease of use and reliability that you've come to expect from Zoom meetings. Zoom Phone works seamlessly within the Zoom app as your business phone system to make and receive phone calls, capture call recordings, and easily escalate to video if the need arises. And it works wherever you are, in the office or on your mobile device. Sign up for Zoom Phone online at zoom.com and meet happy with Zoom.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 25th of March, these are our main stories. The Indian government has imposed a lockdown on its 1.3 billion people to stop the spread of coronavirus. New York State says its hospitals could soon be overwhelmed, but President Trump says he wants the US businesses to reopen by Easter. In Italy, the rate of infection appears to be flattening. Also in this podcast, Iraqi healthcare workers say they don't have the equipment they need to deal with the coronavirus.
It's already out of hand here. Our hospitals is not prepared for the virus, you know.
And one of the giants of African music, Manu Dibango, has died. India has imposed a total lockdown on its population. The Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, urged the country's 1.3 billion people to stay at home to avoid spreading the coronavirus.
Corona mahamari ke khilaf nirnayak ladai ke liye ye kadam.
This is an essential step in this decisive battle against the corona pandemic. No doubt this lockdown will entail an economic cost to the country, but saving the life of each and every Indian, of you, of your family, is the first priority for me, my government, and every state.
Let's hear from my correspondent in Delhi, Zubair Ahmed.
The Prime Minister had, tried to make people ready for this moment on Sunday when he appealed to the people to observe a day-long self-imposed curfew. And then after that, soon after that, several states and union territories of India declared a complete lockdown. So already much of India was in a complete lockdown, but this announcement was expected not so soon. But people were bracing themselves for this moment, and now they are going to stay indoors for the next 21 days. It's going to be hard for the authorities to implement this step because during the curfew hours in Delhi, we saw lots of people coming out and doing last-minute shopping before the Prime Minister made this announcement.
People in India can see what's happening in other countries around the world. On the other hand, these sort of restrictions in any country have an enormous economic cost, not only to the country as a whole, but to individuals. What sort of reaction is there then from people in India to it?
Well, people have largely embraced it. They say they're going to abide by the appeal of the Prime Minister. But then you have the opposition leaders who are asking, what is the government going to do about people living rough on the streets in big cities like Mumbai and Delhi? They are daily wage earners. There are farmers, poor farmers in villages. How are they going to sustain themselves if the government has no plans to help them financially? And the Prime Minister, in his half-hour address to the nation, has made no reference to the help that he plans to dole out to the poor people. But I'm hearing that there will be an economic package announced very soon.
Zubair Ahmed with me from Delhi. In the US, around 50,000 people have been infected with coronavirus and approximately 600 have died, many in New York City. The World Health Organization says this could be the next hotspot for the virus. President Trump, meanwhile, tweeted that people should return to work. He explained why to Fox News.
Our country is not built to shut down. Our people are full of vim and vigor and energy. They don't want to be locked into a house or an apartment or some space. We're not built that way. And I said, you know, I don't want the cure to be worse than the problem itself, the problem being obviously the problem. And, you know, you can destroy a country this way by closing it down. I mean, we had the best economy in the history of our country 3 weeks ago. And then all of a sudden, we're supposed to shut it down. Look, we lose thousands and thousands of people a year to the flu. We don't turn the country off.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington told me more about the scale of the epidemic in the US.
Well, the phrase that's always used, isn't it, with COVID-19 is exponential. And we have seen exponential rises in infections and deaths here. I mean, when I was talking about this time last week, we were looking at deaths in two-digit numbers. We're now looking at almost 600 deaths. We were looking at diagnoses in the sort of low hundreds, and now we're looking at nearly 50,000 people being diagnosed with COVID-19. So the numbers are rising hugely, and they're hitting particularly hard in places like New York, where the governor, Andrew Cuomo, is expecting the caseload at its peak to get to 140,000 people. So he's obviously dealing with quite a situation there where they're having to demand that every hospital in the state adds 50% of beds to their numbers, and if they can, 100%, doubling the bed numbers in New York State overall. That's how bad they think it's going to get there in the coming weeks. They're also, you know, requisitioning a huge art center on the west side of Manhattan. That's going to have a couple of thousand beds in it now. There are some real hot spots, and there are some parts of the country where it's barely registering at all.
It seems odd, given that context, to hear President Trump talk about people going back to work and the country starting to get back to normal by Easter.
Yes, I mean, he's been talking, I think, slightly at cross purposes with his scientific advisers as well, because they clearly believe that this sort of shutdown, this lockdown, if you like, needs to continue, certainly in the parts of the country where the virus is spreading rapidly, that it needs to continue for some while yet, where, as he's talking about, coming out of it possibly by Easter. I think that will worry a lot of people. He's talking about it being necessary for economic reasons, but he's also suggesting that in some sense the cure could be worse than the problem itself if it goes on for too long, suggesting perhaps there would be people committing suicide because they had to stay at home, and people's businesses going under, and, you know, trying to compare what's happening to the fact that the country doesn't shut down over the number of road deaths each year. So there's a very mixed message coming out, given that this time last week the president himself was saying we might have to be in this state until July or August.
And tell me, Gary, about the rescue package that's supposedly going through the Senate.
Well, they've been talking about this one for 5 days. They've already passed a couple worth in excess of $100 billion. This one is a mammoth one, though. This is $2 trillion worth. And to give you some sort of scale, that's about 10% of US GDP. It has various elements to it. The Democrats want more of the money sort of guided towards individuals and workers. The Republicans want more of it guided towards businesses. They're arguing over who has oversight over particular corporate rescue funds. But they are getting closer, apparently, to some sort of deal. And if they agree it would then also have to go through the House. But I think once Senate Democrats agree, then House Democrats will probably agree too.
Gary O'Donoghue with me from Washington. Now, as officials around the world urge people to stay at home, our health reporter Laura Foster has been looking at how isolation can save lives.
A big problem with coronavirus is you can have it and not know about it. It means you can go about your day as you've always done, feel completely fine, but actually infect around 2 to 3 people within a week. What happens then is those people you infected go on to infect another 2 to 3 people each. And then those people will infect others, and that's how the virus spreads. But look at what happens when people stay at home and practice social distancing. For instance, if this person didn't go round to their friend's house, if this person worked from home, this reduces the number of cases from 406 to just 15. As the number of cases goes down, so does the pressure on doctors and nurses and on our health service. This will make the difference between people living and people dying.
Italy has been in lockdown for several days, and while the number of cases there continues to rise, the rate of increase has now slowed. Our Rome correspondent Mark Lowen has more.
For the third day in a row, the infection rate here is slowing. 54,030 people in Italy currently have coronavirus. That's an increase of just over 7% on yesterday. It's the slowest rise since the outbreak began and is now starting to look like a downward trend in new infections. Deaths, though, have risen again. 743 people killed by the virus in the past 24 hours, up from 601. But it's the infection rate which the authorities here will look at closest. It seems to show that the nationwide restrictions are working. Tonight, the Prime Minister said he hopes very soon to be able to loosen the measures, but has increased the fine for breaking the rules from a maximum of €206, that's £190, to €3,000, more than £2,700. Much now depends on the rest of this week. If the infection rate continues to decline, the government will be able to tell Italians that their sacrifice is paying off.
Research into the virus is in full swing, both to understand its makeup and to develop vaccines against it. Work is also being done on investigating why different people respond in different ways to infection. One area of study is blood type. Chris Smith is a consultant virologist at Cambridge University.
It's not just confined to this particular virus, though. We've known for a while that some blood types are associated with an increased risk of having a bad outcome from viruses, but it's certainly true in this case as well. There's data from Wuhan, and I looked up the numbers, actually. If you look at the prevalence of certain blood groups in the population, and then you ask, are people in the intensive care unit in hospital appearing there in the same proportion as their blood group? In other words, if they make up a third of the population, do they make up a third of the population of ITU patients? The answer is no, a disparity emerges. So people with blood group A, they make up 31% of the population in Wuhan in China. Well, actually, they were 38% of patients who had severe infections. Contrast that with people who are blood group O, who are 34% of the population, were only in ITU 25% of the time. Okay. So there does appear to be a protective effect of group O blood and an exacerbation of risk of your group A blood.
Chris Smith from Cambridge University. Still to come in this podcast, overburdened hospitals in the US cancel procedures that are deemed less urgent.
I was supposed to have that surgery on March 20th, and I was told that they were canceling that surgery because of the coronavirus.
In Spain, harrowing footage from a Madrid hospital has emerged. It's believed the video was filmed a couple of days ago, and it shows people sprawled on the floor in crowded corridors, coughing, hooked up to oxygen tanks. The total number of deaths now stands at almost 2,700. The number of infections has surged towards 40,000. Daniel Lopez Acuna, a former WHO official, is now professor of the Andalusian School of Public Health.
I think we are observing the fully fledged transmission of the last 2 weeks. As the Director General of WHO said yesterday, it took 67 days to get the 100,000 first cases in the world, 11 days to get the second 100,000, and 4 days to get the third 100,000. So I think all countries should look into this explosive nature of the epidemic and really anticipate as much as possible the measures, both in terms of public health interventions, healthcare preparedness, and containment and lockdown.
Madrid is one of the epicentres of the outbreak in Spain. I asked the journalist James Badcock, who's in the Spanish capital, about reports of an ice rink being used as a morgue.
More of a chilling metaphor could there be, really? A place which, of course, cannot now be used for its usual function, where a place of public fun and enjoyment and socialising, of course, under lockdown, nobody's out in the streets having fun, and the dead are piling up. Because with 1,500 or more than 1,500 deaths already just in the Madrid region, the funeral parlours and the cemeteries just can't keep pace. But you know, there is hope. There are signs of a tapering off. The increases are still daily, but they are now of a lower nature, especially in Madrid. And in terms of deaths, also nationally, the increases in recent days have been going down just a little day by day. It was 30%, then 27% today, 23% increase in deaths, even though it's a record overall figure. Of course, the massive amount of people who are being infected is what's really affecting the health system, even though we may be getting to the peak. That's obviously where the strain is absolutely total on the health system. And we've seen images like you see. I've been able to verify at least one of those videos. Some of Madrid's hospitals did virtually collapse, they say, over the weekend. But they say that they were able to spread patients out to other hospitals. They've also medicalized hotels. And even the city's massive convention center is being turned into a huge sort of field hospital.
There are also reports of people being abandoned in nursing homes and left to die.
I think this is possibly the worst story really we've come across so far in Spain. It's they were perhaps the least prepared places. I've spoken to today I've been speaking to people who work in these places, and they don't have the equipment of a hospital. They say they don't even have protective equipment, meaning a lot of the staff, a lot of the auxiliary nurses in especially in private residences for the elderly are coming down with COVID-19. So staffing levels are already being reduced. They say they just can't get around to look after everyone, and people are dying almost, you know, under their noses before they can hardly realize how serious they are. It's a really, really terrible situation. And I think it's basically that these homes, while they have some, you know, healthcare knowledge, and of course they have nurses and so on, and they're normally prepared for the occasional, you know, slow rate of illness and so on, and they can call an ambulance and so on, they've just been completely flooded, and they've just been, they say, completely under-equipped to deal with it.
James Badcock in Madrid. So far, Iraq has relatively few confirmed cases of coronavirus, but health experts have warned this could change without action being taken. What's more, the country is severely lacking in medical equipment and facilities. My colleague Nuala McGovern has been talking to Dr. Nabeel Sahib, who's a pharmacist in the city of Kerbala near Baghdad.
Our hospitals is not prepared for the virus, you know. It's no places for isolation. And no medical supplies.
So what is the government saying?
The government don't say anything. It's already out of hand here. We have very bad medical system, very bad medical regime, you know.
And have they said to people you must stay in your house?
They told that, and they made the rule about that, but cannot control on the people. You know Karbala and Najaf and Samarra is a holy city in Iraq. And so you cannot ban people from the visit the religion site. Also, yesterday we have Iranian come to Kerbala.
That is worrying disaster. Because Iran has had so many cases.
Yeah, I know. It's a disaster. But we cannot do anything about that.
So Nasser, what about you? I mean, for you to try and stay safe.
We only have the mask for dust and only have the gloves. And even alcohol for detergent, we don't have in our hospital. We pray to God not to be worse.
Dr. Nabeel Sahib with Nuala McGovern. Even in highly developed countries, coronavirus has put healthcare systems under immense strain. One of the byproducts of the pandemic is that treatments for other illnesses, which are deemed to be not as imminently life-threatening, have been cancelled, both to avoid spreading the virus and to make room for patients who've tested positive for it. Mary Miscansis lives in the US state of Illinois. She was scheduled to have cancer surgery last week.
Basically, I've been going through stage 3 breast cancer treatments for the past 2 years, and it has spread out of the breasts and has moved into different areas of my body. And the one area that they're very suspicious of and the nature of the way it is the uterus. The hormonal cancer might have gotten into the uterus and it needs a hysterectomy. Well, I was supposed to have that surgery on March 20th. And the Monday before that, Friday, I was told that they were canceling that surgery because of the coronavirus. They kind of like said it was a hospital director that made the decision on this.
Mary Miscansis in Illinois. African countries are ramping up their efforts to minimize the impact of coronavirus. It's a race to buy time for fragile health systems. There are more than 1,800 confirmed cases on the continent, with Nigeria, Gambia and Zimbabwe reporting their first deaths this week. Now, while Africa hasn't been as affected as the rest of the world, cases are now starting to rise. Our Southern Africa reporter Phumzile Fulani has more from Johannesburg.
Lawmakers across the continent are scrambling to pass or tighten laws aimed at curbing the spread of coronavirus. For Senegal, Ivory Coast and Sudan, this has meant declaring a state of emergency so their governments can enforce curfews that will restrict movement during certain times of the day. Governments are hoping the message around social distancing and repeated hand washing will be complied with, but some are not taking chances. South Africa is going on a lockdown for 21 days on Thursday. The country has 554 confirmed cases, the highest on the continent. A growing number of these are now from local transmissions. As the country prepares for a shutdown, officials say they want to use that period to focus their testing efforts on high-density areas amid concerns that there might be hundreds of infected people in poorer communities who simply have not been tested. Officials say they have learned some lessons from countries including Italy, UK and the US, which are still battling with containing the virus, but the test of that will be in the saving of lives and restarting the continent's already struggling economies in the aftermath of the outbreak.
Coronavirus has claimed the life of one of the giants of African music. Cameroon's Manu Dibango has died in Paris after contracting the illness. He was 86. Our Africa regional editor Mary Harper reports.
Manu Dibango was a big star across Africa, Europe and beyond. His unique blend of jazz, funk and Cameroonian sounds influenced bands from Kool and the Gang in the 70s to hip-hop groups in the 90s. He had a musical upbringing, much of it spent in church where his mother led a choir. He was sent to colonial France to study, but was so distracted by music that he failed his exams. Dibango was always clear that he should not be stereotyped as an African musician. Dibango, or Grandpa Groove as he was known in later life, collaborated with artists from all over the world, including Herbie Hancock and Fela Kuti. In 2009, he sued two famous singers, Michael Jackson and Rihanna, for allegedly appropriating some of his lyrics. He eventually settled out of court. Show!
Mary Harper on the life of Manu Dibango. And that's all from us for now. There will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you'd like to comment on this edition, do drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. My name's Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. Until next time, goodbye.
Great podcasts deserve a great platform. That's why Pocket Cast delivers a beautifully designed, simple, but powerful experience that offers more control. It's the premium app for podcast listening, search, and discovery. And it's now free. Download Pocket Cast today at pocketcast.com or find us in the Apple App or Google Play stores.